Spanish translation, which is strategies for engineered negligible senescence. He is the editor-in-chief of Rejuvenation Research, which is the world's only peer-reviewed journal focused on intervention in aging. His research interests focus on the accumulating and eventually pathogenic molecular and cellular side effects of metabolism, in other words, damage. This damage constitutes mammalian aging. Norbury's work seeks to design the interventions that are necessary for its repair and for its obviation. He has developed a potentially comprehensive plan for such a term, strategies for engineered negligible senescence. This breaks the aging problem down into 7 major classes of damage and identifies detailed approaches to addressing each one. And in 2007, Aubrey published his book, Ending Aging, to bring his ideas to a wider audience. So in all the time that I've known Aubrey, he's never really shied away from controversy. He feels very strongly that he needs to get his message across and he needs lots of people to hear his message. And he makes us all think outside the box, which is a very important thing. So today he's going to talk to us about longevity as a side benefit of truly good health. What's the problem?
All right, thank you very much, everyone. And thank you for coming. So, I was going to use notes, but I'm only going to use one page of notes, and it's a page that I wrote during Brian's remarks. I realised before coming here that since I was going to be speaking second, it might be might give more coherence to the event if I tried to cover more or less the same ground, but from a somewhat different perspective. And I rather suspected that Brian would indeed be so generous as he has been to give a spectacularly dismal account of what he thinks is going to happen in the future. I must say he's really done justice to that famous description of the self advantage. So anyway, I think I will cover quite a lot of ground in the next 40 minutes. I'm going to start actually more or less where Brian ended. I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on cryonics. Now, first, I'm going to ask a question to which I do, in fact, know the answer. Is there anybody in the room who is signed up to be cryopreserved when they become legally dead? Hand up. Okay, the answer to the question is, in fact, yes, because I am. I think that cryonics is a perfectly reasonable concept. I think that the idea of arresting the process of what you might call biological death, which is a process, not an instantaneous event, before it has gone far enough to make it inconceivable that we could ever reverse it, it is a perfectly reasonable way to deal with things. And in fact, the country of Brian's birth, Australia, is perhaps the most visionary country in this regard, at least in respect of the insurance industry. Some of you may know that most people who are signed up to be cryopreserved seek to obtain the indeed very substantial amounts of money that are required for the process by having life insurance, for which one of the cryonics companies is the beneficiary. And an Australian insurance company is, I think, unique still in having actually refused to offer life insurance for people in this regard, because they reasoned that if cryonics have any legitimate biological basis, then the individuals who are being cryopreserved are in fact not dead, and therefore life insurance should not be paid out. We will see whether that interpretation actually becomes more prevalent as time goes on. But to come back more directly to what Brian said about cryonics, I want to actually tell you another anecdote, which is again perfectly true. Which is about the concept that Brian put forward as supposedly a modest proposal, namely that people might be cryopreserved before they become legally dead. In other words, when they're in a relatively good condition. As I mentioned, the process of biological death is a process. It's a complicated process. A lot of things happen. And for most of us, at least historically, it has generally been assumed that the process of decay of the body actually doesn't progress very far until one's heart stops, and so one becomes legally dead. And that's really what makes cryonics make sense. But of course, there is a somewhat conspicuous exception to that, which is the process of neurodegeneration, dementia, typified by Alzheimer's disease. I think it can fairly be said that Ronald Reagan was biologically very dead indeed, some time before he was legally dead. And people who are interested in being cryopreserved are of course interested in doing it in order to be restored at some time in the future to health, to both physical and mental good health. So there is a trend among that community to resolve in one or another way to end one's life prematurely so as to be cryopreserved rather than to suffer the advanced stages of dementia. And I think this is really the first step towards exactly what Brian was mentioning, that the idea of cryopreservation before one gets into a state of seriously diminished health, whether physical or mental, might actually not be quite so satirical as you may think. We will see whether this actually happens, but it definitely is not quite so ridiculous an idea as you may have thought when Brian mentioned it. Before I go on to the bulk of my remarks, which will of course be about the desirability, the ethics, the sociological implications and so on of long life, I thought I would spend a few minutes talking about what I actually do. I am, as Deborah mentioned, predominantly a biologist, even though I do spend a lot of my time doing outreach and talking about the social context and so on of this work. So the question then is it realistic to suppose that we might actually be able to bring aging under any significant degree of medical control in the foreseeable future? Now, certainly at the time that I entered the field, which was perhaps 15 years ago, there were very few serious biogerontologists who were even faintly optimistic on this point. Essentially, gerontologists had come to appreciate the, by now I think, indisputable fact that aging is really complicated. Really, really complicated. Pretty much as complicated as being alive in the first place is, and that's certainly pretty complicated. So, basically fixing it is very hard indeed. And gerontologists have, insofar as they view themselves as focused on intervention at all, which of course many gerontologists do not, they have tended to take the view that our best bet is to look at different species and see, for example, or indeed different individuals within a species and compare them and identify perhaps the factors which appear to confer greater longevity, greater, if you like, inbuilt defence against the ageing process, with the view that, to perhaps being able to exploit that knowledge biomedically in the future and thereby essentially extrapolate from what we find out in order to postpone the ill health of old age and thereby keep people in a good state. The work that I've been doing over the past decade or so has been based on a somewhat different concept, which is essentially to say that slowing aging down, which is essentially what I just discussed, is really, really hard to do, really, really hard in fact, because it essentially involves understanding our metabolism well enough that we can tweak it, we can clean it up without doing more harm than good. But that it may actually be easier to intervene somewhat later in the chain of events that lead from, if you like, being alive to being dead. Not so late in the chain of events as contemporary medicine for old age diseases does, geriatric medicine, in other words, treating the actual pathology of old age, but doing what we might think of as preventative maintenance, periodically going in and addressing, in particular repairing, the various types of molecular and cellular damage that our normal essential metabolic processes inflict on our body. The thing about this damage is that it's initially harmless until there's too much of it. We know it's harmless because, you know, people at the age of 25 or 30 or 40 are still doing perfectly well. You know, I can still run and think pretty much as fast as I could 15 years ago, which is, you know, good news really. It means that so long as we can reasonably thoroughly repair this damage every so often, we ought to be able to keep it down to a level of abundance that is what we might think of as subpathogenic. In other words, simply does not actually cause the diseases, the ill health of old age with which we are so familiar and which we would so like to avoid. Now, It's taken a little while for this concept to gain credence and legitimacy, largely because essentially what I'm proposing is the application of regenerative medicine to the problem of aging. Regenerative medicine, as all of you are probably aware, incorporates fields such as stem cell therapy, tissue engineering. When properly defined, it's somewhat broader than that. It should also really be defined to incorporate what we might think of as molecular regenerative medicine, the elimination of molecular garbage, molecular byproducts of metabolism that the cell does not succeed in either breaking down or excreting, and which therefore accumulate, whether inside the cell or outside. Those sorts of things. So regenerative medicine against aging. The thing is that regenerative medicine has historically been developed for application to acute injury, things like spinal cord damage and such like, and not predominantly with a view to treating chronic problems, which of course aging certainly is. And conversely, gerontologists have not typically been involved very much in the development of regenerative medicine. So a lot of my work in the scientific community has entailed essentially bringing these two communities of scientists together to investigate and discuss the extent to which regenerative medicine might plausibly be applied to aging. And certainly after a decade or so of doing that, I have been very powerfully reinforced in my opinion that this is actually an extremely plausible route, that we have a very respectable chance in the next few decades of developing regenerative medicine against the various problems of aging that is sufficiently comprehensive to actually work, to actually postpone the ill health of old age very substantially indeed. And as already been mentioned, I have a bit of a reputation for pointing out the longevity consequences of that, namely that it seems to me very likely that we will be able to postpone the ill health of old age indefinitely, which will lead to an expectation of longevity that we can calculate by looking at the mortality rates that we see in the West in young adults today. That mortality rate is rather low, and if you look at numbers, depending on which population you look at, it varies, of course, by maybe a factor of two either way, but we're looking at more or less an average lifespan of 1,000 years. Now, I always do have to point out that this is actually a completely notional number because it's based, as I just mentioned, on the assumption that the mortality rates from causes of death other than aging, in other words, the mortality rates that are experienced by young adults, will remain the same indefinitely as they are today, which is, of course, a completely crazy assumption. But, you know, people do ask me this question, and I feel it's important to answer straight questions with straight answers. However, I do want to absolutely emphasize that all of this work is on health. The longevity side effect of the postponement of aging using regenerative medicine will be a side effect, will be exactly that. The purpose here is to stop people from getting sick. I do not work on longevity. I do not work on stopping people from being hit by trucks, and I also do not work on making people live to 1,000. I work on stopping people from getting the diseases of old age, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, and so on. And that's actually where I want to start in discussing the social and ethical context of this work. Here's another question for all of you. Hands up anyone who wants to get Alzheimer's disease. Well, that was easy. All right. Furthermore, hands up anyone who wants to get Alzheimer's disease so long as they don't get it until they're at least 100. Excellent. Still, nobody wants Alzheimer's. Nobody wants to get Alzheimer's however long they live. And really, from an individualist perspective, that's really all you need to know. The fact is that nobody wants to get sick. And also, it's pretty much the case that nobody wants to die unless they get sick and irreversibly sick. You know, actually, even when people do get fairly sick, they tend to want to hang on. But at least when they're physically healthy, it's pretty rare to want to die anytime soon. And furthermore, if you do want to die anytime soon, despite the fact that you're still physically and mentally healthy, we have a word for you. We call you suicidal. And we try to change your mind. We try quite hard, and we're quite pleased, most of us, that there exist organizations like the Samaritans that are very good at changing the minds of people like that. So, from an individualist perspective, I think it's pretty damn clear that there is no ethical argument. It simply is the case that we have voted with our feet. We like the idea of staying healthy, and we like the idea of staying alive while we're healthy. So the first place I want to start in addressing some of the issues that Brian mentioned is to look at the issue that I think was actually one of the first things Brian mentioned, namely the potential dichotomy between the individual perspective from an ethical or radical point of view, as opposed to the sociological perspective. Pretty much everybody who counts as deficit, in other words, who in some way defends aging and opposes, or at least is ambivalent about the idea of developing medicine against aging, uses arguments from sociology. They more or less all accept that, yes, individuals want to stay healthy and they want to stay alive while they're healthy, but they say, well, yeah, that's all very well, but you've got a bit of a problem with the sociological consequences. But I think it's very shaky to say that as well, because let's face it, if we focus on the fact that the Tithonus error, so to speak, is an error, in other words, that combating aging is not about keeping people alive in a frail state, but rather it's about keeping people alive in a healthy state, if we remember that, and therefore we remember that the longevity benefits of all of this are a side benefit, then we can ask ourselves what the sociological issues are, whether there is indeed any sociological uncertainty, or ethical, or political, or theological uncertainty, about contemporary medicine. Let's face it, contemporary medicine is about keeping people alive, although it really is just the same. The only difference between what I and my colleagues do and what the whole of the medical profession does is that I think that we have a respectable chance within the foreseeable future of keeping people healthy so well that they actually live quite a lot longer than they currently do, well, at least they probably will. Whereas at the moment, we seem not to have too much issue with medicine simply because it doesn't work very well. But we've actually, if we look at the history of medicine, got a pretty good precedent here. Because we used to have medicine against infectious diseases that didn't work very well. And then suddenly people like Jenner and Pasteur came along, and the whole field of immunology came along. And lo and behold, we started to be very good indeed at combating infant mortality, combating infectious diseases, which used to wipe out nearly 40% of babies before they even reached the age of one in the UK. Now, if I were Louis Pasteur standing here 150 years ago, and I were to say to you, hello, I have figured out how to stop all this infant mortality, and you all cheer and wave your programs and everything, and then some troublemaker at the back stands up and says, hang on, everybody's having 10 kids, if they all survive, won't there be a bit of an overpopulation problem? You know, and everyone turns around and they look terribly worried and they suddenly begin to be ambivalent about all this. And I said, no, it's going to be fine. We're all going to wear these repulsive rubber contraptions whenever we have sex. Everything's going to be okay. You know, 150 years ago, I would not have been taken seriously. But the fact is that it all happened really rather quickly. Just because children are expensive, it didn't take any draconian legislation or anything. Now, this is a pretty salutary piece of evidence that we haven't the faintest idea what humanity of the future is likely to choose to do in the context of a new opportunity. Because that's what it is, it's an opportunity. We don't have to use technology that eliminates the ill health of old age if we don't want to. But we do, in my view, have a very straightforward, a very clear and present moral obligation to develop the therapies that will allow humanity of the future to do exactly that, to eliminate the ill health of old age, because humanity of the future is entitled to have that choice. If we look at the question that comes up the most frequently in this area, which is another one that Brian talked about a bit ill, namely the problem of resources due to the risk of overpopulation, then ultimately we can just look at the numbers and we can say, well, hang on, population growth globally, let's forget migration, let's talk about global population. Population growth depends not on the death rate, it depends on the difference between the death rate and the birth rate. At the moment, many of you may not know this, but at the moment it turns out that more than twice as many people are born each day as die. The number of people that die each day is roughly 150,000 worldwide. The number that are born is roughly 350,000. So even if we completely eliminate, totally completely eliminate all deaths, not just death from aging, today, all we would need to do would be halve the birth rate, and we'd be done. We'd have a declining global population. Think about that. Now, of course, one has to do much more complicated calculations in order to understand what would be likely to happen in the long, in the more distant future. But as I say, the distant future is not something about which we have an ability, and therefore it's not something about which we have any kind of moral justification to actually discuss in detail. We just don't know what it's going to be like, because we don't know what types of other technological change are going to accompany the next few decades while these therapies are being developed. And let's remember that all discussions about resources, and indeed all discussions about longevity, as opposed to simply discussions about the health of people who are alive, depend on looking at the distant future. They depend on that simply because we're still only going to get older at 1 year per year. You know, we're not going to have any 1,000-year-old people for 900 years, whatever happens, right? And other technologies tend to be developed and to advance a good deal more rapidly than that. In fact, increasingly rapidly, as all of you are very, very well aware. So we've absolutely got no choice. We've got to develop these therapies in order to give humanity of the future the option of whether to use them or not. Now, I want to address a number of specific sociological questions that Brian mentioned, because they were all very interesting, and they're all indeed ones that I come across quite frequently, so they must be interesting to you folks too. One thing that I want to mention is in relation to fertility. So, I've already mentioned that all we need to do is half the birth rate and we'd be done. Okay. Now, you may think that that's a somewhat curious use of the word all, because certainly, you know, it's not easy to persuade people to have fewer kids. But another thing that has to be taken into account in the predictions that we may make about the impact of medicine against aging is the age at which the average woman has their kids. When we talk about fertility rate these days, we talk about it in terms of the total number of children that a woman has in her whole life. And that's a pretty reasonable thing to do, because the range of ages during which that woman has those children is relatively narrow. It's not many people have children before the age of 20, in the West anyway, and pretty much nobody has children over the age of 50. But menopause, which is of course the reason for the latter of those two things, is one of the things we're going to fix. Those of you who don't fancy the idea of having a period every month for 1,000 years, don't worry, we can probably turn it on and off. But the point is that we're going to be able to make it possible as a side effect, as an example of the things we're going to fix in aging, to have children safely without any risk of Down syndrome or anything, at any age you like. Now, that's rather important in our predictions of what's likely to happen demographically, because one thing that we see today is not only, as Brian very correctly mentioned, a clear reduction in the total fertility rate, in other words, the total number of children that the average woman has, that accompanies the introduction of prosperity and emancipation of women in any society. I don't think there's a single exception to that. That's not all we see. We also see, concomitantly, an increase in the average age at which women have their children. And, of course, there may be very many different reasons for that, but ultimately it all comes down to women taking the opportunity to do other things with their lives before they do this terribly time-consuming thing. It seems pretty much inescapable that when the biological guillotine, what we might call it, the deadline for having kids is removed, that an awful lot of women are going to make the choice to delay having their kids by another decade, another decade. And if one factors that into the calculation of the trajectory of global population, bearing in mind that it's essentially front-loaded, it affects birth rates immediately, one gets really, so these calculations have not been done in detail, and actually my foundation is about to fund a project that will look at this. But as you can all see intuitively, that is going to make a very significant difference to what that trajectory will actually look like. And it may indeed be sufficient completely to eliminate the risk of a serious overpopulation problem in the context of medicine against aging. Another thing Brian mentioned was the economic aspect of all of this. And one thing that, that Brian very correctly drew attention to was the fact that old people are very profitable to the drug companies, to the medical profession in general. That's where the medical profession makes its money. So the medical profession is not terribly keen on the idea of keeping people healthy. However, there is a little bit of a flaw in that argument. In fact, there are two flaws. One of them is that medicine to keep people healthy is also going to be expensive and therefore profitable to the medical profession. Because it's going to be preventative maintenance, so it's going to have to be done periodically, and it's going to be high tech. There's going to be a lot of tricky things to do. So it seems to me that there's going to be no shortage of ways to make money out of drugs and medical therapies in the future any more than there is now. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the medical profession is closely linked to the health insurance and life insurance industry. And the life insurance industry are quite keen on the idea of people living longer because people are going to carry on paying their premiums. And, of course, that also applies to health insurance. The money going into the insurance company will substantially exceed the money coming out, being paid out in medical treatments, simply because the people will continue to be healthy and therefore they will not be consuming medical resources. So actually the economic arithmetic is quite complicated, but the bottom line is pretty unequivocally that these therapies will be economically extremely sound investments. And that is an extremely important point in relation to another area that Brian touched on to some extent, namely the question of availability, of access to these therapies. If I first just simply address the question of availability within the Western world, in other words, within nations that are prosperous, the issue here is, would these therapies be available only to people who are sufficiently wealthy, or would they be available to everybody? And the economic arguments that I've just given, plus other economic arguments in relation to pensions, which I'm going to come to in a moment, actually tell us the answer to that very quickly indeed. Because the fact is, being frail when you're elderly is spectacularly expensive to the economy. It's spectacularly expensive in terms of direct costs of medical care. And I've just come from visiting my mother who needs daily care at the moment, and so I have personal involvement in that. But also, the indirect costs are enormous. The loss of productivity of the loved ones of the elderly, and all manner of other indirect costs that I don't have to enumerate, so you can imagine them all yourself. So, in fact, calculations have been done on this. The bottom line of which is that the majority of the increase in GDP that's been seen in the industrialized world since World War II has actually resulted from the increase in longevity and the increase in productivity of the elderly population. Despite the fact that, of course, we haven't actually done very much. We've only extended average longevity by perhaps 10 years since World War II, and we have not significantly reduced. In fact, some people would say we've actually slightly increased the time at the end of life, which is unhealthy and therefore very expensive. So you can see what that means if we end up in a situation where we're not having any ill health at the end of old age because we're postponing the ill health of old age indefinitely and having people only getting early dying from typically very sudden causes of death, like being hit by trucks. So it's actually pretty clear that it would be economically suicidal for any nation not to make these therapies free at the point of delivery to everybody, irrespective of their ability to pay. These therapies will pay for themselves but so many fold that it would be simply impossible for countries that restricted access to these therapies and thereby continued to have the economic burden of age-related ill health to compete with countries that we offer to visit. That's quite a pleasant thought, and I appreciate that it's counterintuitive because, of course, today what we see in high-tech medicine is very much the opposite, that the more expensive medicine is, the more unlikely it is to be universally available. But honestly, the logic is inescapable. The only reason that the treatments that I'm discussing here, the putative future application of regenerative medicine to aging, does not follow the precedent of high-tech medicine today, is that the economic arithmetic is inverted. At the moment, high-tech medicine basically doesn't work, so we end up spending a large amount of money keeping people relatively healthy for a short amount of time, and then we spend the same amount of money that we ever would have done keeping them alive in a state of poor health for more or less the same period of time as we otherwise would have done, so we don't actually end up with anything else to gain, we end up simply spending more money than we otherwise would have done. That will not be the case in respect of medicines against aging. I want to also come back to this whole idea of pessimism about aging, because I speak to a wide variety of different audiences. And, of course, they have very different attitudes, different perspectives about all manner of different aspects of this whole question. But one thing that I come across extraordinarily pervasively is a willingness to be, well, when I'm feeling particularly uninhibited, I call it intellectually dishonest, to be honest, about this particular question. People who are thinking about this tend to be perfectly happy to take the view that the medical elimination of aging, of the ill health of old age, is simply impossible. And even if I spent an hour spelling out exactly how it's going to be done, they will ask questions that are predicated on the assumption that I've just been lying to them, which is a bit of a shame, really. Because, you know, they don't tell me what's actually wrong with what I said, they just assume that I must be wrong because what I'm saying sounds incredible. And I think this is a bit of a shame, really. I think it's really rather important for us to avoid that that trap. Now, I do have a certain amount of sympathy for it. I have used a perhaps somewhat derogatory phrase to describe this attitude, this response to the prospect of defeating aging with medicine. I often call it pro-aging trance. But, to be perfectly honest, I do have a degree of sympathy for it, because ultimately this, what I would call irrational rationalisation of ageing, is something that used not to be irrational until quite recently. Historically, in fact, since the dawn of civilization, we have been acutely aware, painfully aware, that ageing is, first of all, extremely bad for you, and not a lot of fun, and secondly, that it's inevitable, there's nothing we can do about it. And that left us with a rather unfortunate choice. Either we can spend our miserably short lives being preoccupied by this ghastly thing that's going to befall us in the, in most cases, relatively distant future, or we can find some way, thanks, to put it out of our minds, to somehow, you know, get on with our lives and make the best of it without having this sort of damage leaf hanging over our thoughts all the time. And of course, that is the preferable thing to do. We're going to have better quality of life if we're not constantly depressed. So that means that it doesn't actually matter how we do it. It doesn't matter how irrational our rationalizations are, our reasons for rejecting the idea that aging is a bad thing, our reasons for defending aging, if you like. Just as long as they work, just as long as we succeed in tricking ourselves into this false sense of insecurity. It's a great shame, though, that has happened, because now that we are in the state of medical knowledge and research that leads some of us to believe that we are within striking distance of seriously combating aging, the attitude that aging might actually be not such a bad thing anyway is an enormous part of the problem. It holds us back. It's something that stops us from putting nearly enough effort into the attempt to hasten the development of therapies against aging. Because, you know, public opinion obviously pretty much dictates public policy. Public policy dictates funding, and funding dictates what science actually gets done and what science doesn't get done. So that's why I, somewhat reluctantly, but nevertheless, spend an enormous amount of my time beating people over the head with the illogicality of defending aging and the absolute moral necessity to go and do something about aging as soon as possible, to do our absolute utmost to develop therapies against aging as soon as possible. Ultimately, it comes down to a sense of proportion. None of us want to get Alzheimer's, none of us want to get cardiovascular disease or diabetes or macular degeneration or arthritis or any of those things, and we're perfectly happy that that society spends trillions of dollars trying to postpone those things, trying to treat them, and trying to develop new therapies, indeed, that might be able to treat them better. We also understand that preventative medicine is a good thing, that prevention is generally better than cure in most things, and certainly is true in that's true in medicine. But we seem to be perfectly capable of blissfully ignoring the fact that treatment against aging is simply preventative geriatrics. The relationship between aging and the diseases of old age is a very clear one. The diseases of old age are diseases of old age for one reason and one reason only, namely that they are aspects of the later stages of aging. Aging being the lifelong process, the lifelong accumulation of various types of initially harmless molecular and cellular damage. So preventative geriatrics is simply preventative medicine against the diseases for which we are so pathetically failing to develop effective curative medicine. And the sooner that that is actually understood and trumpeted by, of course, the scientific expert opinion, but also by opinion formers of all sorts, Oprah Winfrey, whatever, the sooner we're actually going to get somewhere. And I feel that the attempt to defend aging and to criticise the idea that we ought to do something about aging is something whose time has passed, to be honest. It's simple as that. I have sympathy with it, I see psychologically where it comes from, but I absolutely do not see ethically, sociologically, theologically where it comes from. I'm actually going to end with a remark about the theological implications. Brian, as you mentioned, has worked extensively in that area, and I think it's definitely one a very important one to address. Some people are concerned with the idea that somehow aging is the way things are supposed to be, and that it's in some way morally illegitimate to go after aging biomedically because that would be sort of playing God. But if we actually analyse that concept a little more clearly, we can see that there are a couple of rather serious problems with it. The first problem is the idea that we are in some way usurping God's control over the over how things go by developing treatment against aging. As I said, I don't work on longevity. I work on health. I'm interested in stopping people from getting sick. But if God is omnipotent, then he's not going to have very much trouble striking you down with a thunderbolt, however healthy you are. So it's a little bit crazy, in my view, to be suggesting that there is any sense of playing God in the pursuit of medicine against aging. But I have a strong statement about the theological context of the defeat of this situation, which is that it would be a sin not to do this, not to be working to defeat aging. Why is that? Very simple. Aging causes suffering. And Holy Scripture, of all types, is really rather unequivocal on this point, that suffering is something that we ought to be working to minimise. You know, we only point to the parable of the Good Samaritan as the most conspicuous example of this. We are not supposed to be walking by on the other side and letting suffering continue when we might be in a position to do something about it. We need to be today's Good Samaritans, protecting humanity of the future, perhaps the relatively near future, from the development of the suffering that countless generations have had to endure as a result of simply having been born a long time ago. I'll stop there. Thank you.